Today is Purim, a holiday in the Jewish calendar on which we celebrate our near annihilation more than 2,000 years ago in ancient Persia. Long story short, we celebrate by remembering, eating, and on this particular occasion, dressing up in costume and even getting a little tipsy. It's a mitzvah, a special good deed to lose oneself in the moment. Drop the ego, embrace the miracle, to put it in 21st century terms. I mention it not because I am so religiously observant, I'm not at all, but because it is usually a major party time in Israel. But as with pretty much everything these days, the Purim atmosphere is very subdued. And as you will hear in a moment, so are Yaakov and I. We have a lot to get off our chests today. Hostages, Rafah, misinformation regarding Israel allegedly preventing humanitarian aid from getting through to Gaza. The day after, today, tomorrow, as Yaakov puts it so eloquently, we're kind of stuck. We move on in our discussion to the Shifa Hospital. Why anyone still calls it a hospital when it is clearly a Hamas military base is beyond me. We talk about aid, the political dysfunction in Israel, and the supreme irony that Netanyahu's coalition stalwarts, the ultra-Orthodox, could be what brings down this government. We have a lot to say this week, and we go on a touch longer than usual. On a personal note, I become more convinced each week that we really just have to bring the hostages home and deal with the rest later. That even one hostage was taken has been the worst part of this war. That almost 6 months on, 134 remain in captivity is just too much to bear. The total failure of the army and government to protect its citizens and to repatriate them is gutting the soul of this country. I'm Vivian Berkovich, former Canadian ambassador to Israel, and now living in the fabulous state of Tel Aviv. Stay with us. Hi, Yaakov. How are you today? It's noon on the dot. So I was a little stumped there. Like, do I say good morning, good afternoon?
We say good afternoon and we say happy Purim, as happy as Purim can be.
Yeah, let's skip that part this year. Although, you know, I have to say that in Tel Aviv, people love Purim. They love Purim all over Israel. And it's just a costume-o-rama. People are doing their best and they're dressing up and they're, I think for the sake mostly of kids, trying to maintain some sense of normalcy, but it doesn't feel so festive to me. How about you?
No, it doesn't. And there's obvious reasons why, right? You know,
absolutely. Absolutely. As always, a very eventful week. And I'm just going to open with a real downer, which is, you know, last week you commented that you hoped that today we would be celebrating the return of the hostages, or at least a deal for their return. And sadly, we're not in that position. And I want to start off today with that just devastating, devastating impasse that doesn't stop. And that's the hostages. We believe, well, we know that there are 134 hostages remaining in captivity in Gaza, 134 human beings, among them children, women, very elderly men, men of all ages. And we have been told that maybe 30-ish are no longer alive. We hear quietly that the number of those who have been murdered is probably higher. And last night, there was a kind of devastating, but as yet unconfirmed report on social media that Yagiv Buchstav, who turned 35, I believe, in captivity, apparently put out on their Telegram channel that he died from a lack of food and medicine. I can't even begin. But I want to remind our listeners that his wife, Rimon Kirsht, was the woman who, when she was released in pink pajamas, rather than comply with the Hamas directives
to smile and shake their hands and pretend that she was so sad to be leaving them. Ramon Kirst took a few seconds, paused, and just stared ferociously straight into the eyes of one of the masked Hamas thugs who was escorting her and other hostages to the Red Cross vans. And it was such a powerful moment that certainly went viral in Israel, and I expect many of our listeners will recall that as well. But it's her husband who is, at this point, rumored to have been murdered. We have our hostage crew that was dispatched. When I say crew, I mean our negotiators. We were dispatched yet again to Doha to try to work out some sort of deal. I want you to get into the weeds of that, Yaakov, and just tell us, from your perspective, what, if anything, is going on, and what, if anything, can we dare to expect or hope for with respect to the release of the hostages?
Well, let me just add, because it is Purim, which is supposed to be a happy holiday, but I was looking on social media this morning and I saw a picture of Kfir and Ariel Bibas, the two red-haired little boys, dressed up last year as Batman. And they're still being held in captivity without knowing what's going on with them. And we know for sure they're not dressing up this year. And I mean, this is the crazy reality, I think, with in which we live here in Israel today, where we hope and pray for these hostages. And at the same time, there is a desire for people to go about their lives. And it's very, very difficult to do that. You know, on Friday, there was the head of the Mossad, the head of the Shabak, former General Nitzan Alon, who's running intelligence, the coordinator for the IDF, for the hostages. They all flew off to Doha, Qatar, for another round of talks with the Americans, the Qataris, the Egyptians. It's reported that there was an American compromise that was put on the table that Israel accepted that would be kind of the key for how the release in its initial stage would be done. What would Israel get? Basically, they're talking about a multiple stage deal that would see in the beginning 40 hostages released. Israel would in exchange stop the war in Gaza, allow for a specific number of people to return to northern Gaza from the displaced Palestinians, also release some Palestinian prisoners. Then they get to the women and especially the soldiers who are still in captivity. How many murderers who are sitting in Israeli jails for life sentences, how many would be released per female soldier? So there's a lot of moving parts here. It seems that Israel is doing everything it can to say, okay, we're willing to accept this deal, and throwing the ball back into the court of Hamas for now, but it's still, we're not close to a deal. And it doesn't seem to me that it will happen necessarily anytime soon, although we have to hope that this is real and that these talks will bear fruit.
So one of the issues I have and problems I have with assessing the real possibility of a hostage deal coming to fruition at this stage, almost 6 months into this crisis, is, you know, if you play realpolitik, and Yahya Sinwar is very good at that, I don't see any upside to Hamas making a deal. It's just not in their interest. They don't care about their own civilians. And there's not much upside to them releasing the people who are still in captivity for all kinds of reasons.
Unless the calculation by Hamas, which I have to say, if you think about Sinwar for a moment, he's made a few very smart calculations throughout the war, right? His first, which hasn't really paid off yet, but it seems that we're at this tipping point, is that the world will stop Israel. Right. And we're seeing now the growing, you know, I'm sure many of our listeners saw the cover of The Economist and that Israeli flag, Israel alone, this growing feeling of isolation. Canada your country imposing an arms embargo, which really doesn't mean anything, but it's very symbolic. The Brits are apparently close to making a similar decision. Our defense minister Gallant off to Washington to plead with the U.S. administration to keep up arms deliveries and weapons shipments, because that's coming under a cloud of uncertainty. So Israel's facing some real challenges. What Sinwar's hope is that he'll release 40 hostages in the beginning, and the war will stop for 6 to 7 weeks. And while you listen to government officials like Netanyahu, like some of his other ministers who say, no, we're for sure going into Rafah. We're definitely going into Rafah. There's right. no way we're not going into Rafah. Sinwar's bet is that the war stops. The North quiets down. The world says, puts a massive, massive pressure on Israel. Listen, you stopped. Let's end this already. Let's move on. And the desire to move on is stronger than any other desire. So his gamble is that this will end the war. And that's why he would be inclined to go for definitely a first stage, maybe a second stage. I don't know about the third stage, because you're right. He'll want to leave some bargaining chips by him, some of the hostages he'll want to keep. But he's thinking, and it's a gamble, that this will, a deal will be the end of the war completely.
Here's why I
can't say he's wrong. He might be right.
Here's why I think that it's not in his interest, no matter what. He's got the world by the tail as it is, right? The pressure is all on Israel. He can sit there in his cave. And unfortunately, I believe that every single hostage remaining in captivity has been abused very severely over a long period of time. And I think he's savvy enough to know that they cannot be released to give testimony.
Well, I mean, listen, that is definitely a big concern about the women and what's
the men too. The men too.
I mean, listen, who knows, right? On the other hand, it's really a question, how much does he fear for his survival versus the gamble he'll take of the war coming to an end? And it's difficult to know. What I think you can throw into the mix is all this talk about Rafah, right? What's interesting about it is, as if, first of all, it's as if Israel has made Rafah like, you know, this is the victory. And if we don't go into Rafah, there's no victory. And also the other thing is that if you're going into Rafah, there's a lot of things you have to do ahead of Rafah, which is, for example, move out the civilian population, which Israel hasn't even begun to do. Right. So Rafah's not, it's not as if it might happen tomorrow. We're talking about weeks away anyhow. And we also have to be honest and say for a moment that for the last month, the war has been kind of stuck.
Yeah.
Right. There's not much going. In other words, yes, there's still fighting, but the casualties have gone down mainly because there's not a lot of fighting. Right. There's some isolated incidents in the north, some in the central Gaza Strip and Khan Yunis. But otherwise, I think we're down to 7 or 6 brigades in Gaza from where we were when we had like 3 to 4 divisions. And it's not really a war anymore. It's more already the day after the war. Uh-huh. But no one's willing to admit it's the day after the war, because I think here we run into some personal, political, survival issues also on the Israeli side.
So let's go. I want to focus on Rafah for a bit, because you and I both heard Ron Dermer speaking on a podcast late last week, and in which he positioned the whole Rafah thing. He said, no, we absolutely are doing it. If the whole world turns on us, it doesn't matter. We're going into Rafah. We're going to wipe out the military capability in Rafah, because if we don't, everything up until now was for naught. And he said they have 8,000 very well-trained fighters in Rafah now. And he said, we absolutely have to destroy their military capability. And a lot of it is focused there. So park that. That's what Dermer says. Last night, I don't know if you saw Moshe Yadlin on Channel 12. He was speaking at one point. And in his interview, Amos Yadlin, for our listeners, is like, he's just done everything. He's a general, former general. He was in the Air Force. He was, I believe, military intelligence, defense attaché to the U.S. I mean, this is a guy with some pretty serious credibility. Amos Yadlin said on TV last night, nope, I don't buy it. He said, Rafah can wait. Rafah will be there in 2 months, in 3 months, in 4 months, in 5 months. The hostages won't. All of this, he said, the priority, if you're going to triage this, it absolutely has to be the hostages, and it should have been the hostages from day one. Now, I mean, okay, easy to be an armchair quarterback, except, right? But except
especially
that, you know,
when you're one of the people who was part of the creators of this, what we call the misconception in Israel, but okay.
Yes, exactly. I was just going to say, it was, I think, a couple days before October 7th, he gave a talk at the Washington Institute of Near East Policy in D.C. and was lauding the so-called containment strategy, which he had been a very staunch proponent. Having said that, here we are. Bottom line, we've got Rafah. We've got two strong voices saying very different things.
Here's how I look at it. First of all, you know, Yadlin is part of the establishment, right?
Right.
Which comes with its advantages and disadvantages. Dermer's, I would say one of his advantages is he's not part of the army milieu. And therefore, when he comes to look at something, he does look at it more of an outsider. And that fresh perspective, I think, does give him actually a bit of an advantage. With that said, I do think that we're hanging on Rafah way too much of what this war is about. Rafah is part of, obviously, the Gaza Strip. It needs to be taken. The Hamas presence there needs to be eliminated as much as possible. But it's not as if, even after we go into Rafah and we operate there, I don't know, 2-3 weeks, and we kill a few hundred Hamas guys and a few hundred run away to Egypt or another few hundred run away to the north, it's not as if Hamas is now destroyed. This total victory nonsense that we're hearing coming from the prime minister's office, it's not real. What's more real, and by the way, I just to zoom out for a second, because I think this is important to the answer, what happened this last week in Shifa Hospital, right?
Yeah.
What Shifa Hospital is to me is an example of what the day after this war will look like, right? We pulled out of that area because we had been in Shifa. Hamas comes back. Israel goes back to Shifa, operates there already now almost a week, and rounds up hundreds of terror suspects, kills also another 100 plus. Civilian casualties, so far from what I see, really not existent so far on the Palestinian side. So being very careful in how they're operating inside the hospital. This is what the day after is going to look like. We're going to pull out of areas. Hamas is going to come back, and we're going to have to go back and deal with it. So this idea is, if Rafah stops it, no, Rafah is just another step along the way. So Yadlin is right in the extent that we could do Rafah today, we could do Rafah in a month, we could do Rafah in 2 months. The war is not dependent on Rafah. This is a battle that's going to last for years now. And Gaza needs to become like Jenin or like Nablus, where
right,
we go in as we need to operate. That's the switch we have to make in our minds. And therefore, when I hear this whole thing about Rafah, 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 what I think is people are making Rafah into this big deal for a different reason. They want it to be the hill they die on politically. In other words, Netanyahu wants to show his voters, I am standing up for you because I want total victory. The world wants to stop me. I won't let them stop me because I am the strong Israeli prime minister who will stand up for what's right for Israel. And people like that. And he's doing that more for political purposes than for security purposes.
And people in this country still feel very fundamentally abandoned and betrayed by the institutions that are supposed to protect them and care about them.
They do. But on the other hand, Vivian, look at the polls. He still is pulling in almost 20 seats based on polls, which means there still is a strong space of support for Netanyahu and for what he's doing. And I think that his gamble is that if he keeps up this line of I am like the guy, you know, with the finger in the dam, I'm going to do what's right for Israel, even at the cost of me not being accepted by the rest of the world, that's the price I'm going to pay, for example. People like that. And I think that that's his calculation right now. Rafah for him is about politics to some extent, right? Now, the question will be, what happens if there's a deal which kind of delays Rafah? There's a deal for the hostages that will delay Rafah. that will lead to a 6 to 7 week suspension or ceasefire, could see massive protests take to the streets in that period, massive pressure not to renew the war. That's where things will start to look a little different. So I don't, you know, hard
not
to know how this is all going
to
play.
Not to mention the Northern Front sort of, you know, blowing up on us, right?
Minor or detail. Going the opposite direction, or Hezbollah saying, now that there's a ceasefire, we're stopping, we're done.
Yeah.
And so, then suddenly there's quiet on all fronts. And let's also keep something in mind. The desire to go back to normal is always going to be stronger than anything else.
The thing with Shifa that I, you know, kind of baffles me, and I'm sure many people out there, is we went into Shifa early on, sort of did what had to be done. We go back in X months later, and oh, wow, shocker. Hundreds of Hamas and PIJ, Palestinian and Islamic Jihad terrorists, are using it as a base. I mean, how does that happen militarily?
Well, you know, this comes down to the question of what presence, if at all, does the IDF want to keep in Gaza after the high-intensity stage of this conflict? And there's a lot of discussion on, is there going to be a presence in Gaza? Is there not going to be a presence in Gaza? I think that we all can imagine what would have happened had Israel left soldiers in the vicinity of Shifa, and what it would be accused of and what the world would be saying about it and things along those lines. Not that it's not being said anyhow, but I also think that it's what to look at here again is the type of systematic operations Israel is going to have to carry out in Gaza. There's no knockout victory here in this war. There's no victory in that sense. We have to get those Hollywood images or scenarios out of our minds. They don't exist. This is
in
going
reality.
To
be. Exactly.
Yeah. This is going to be different.
Are you concerned with what is going on in Israel? This is not just another crisis. State of Tel Aviv is committed to delivering superb and candid analysis, and we're offering a limited-time subscription special, a 33% discount from the regular fee of $90 annually. 1 year for only $60. Stay informed and stay connected with State of Tel Aviv. We are a reader-supported enterprise. If you value our work, please subscribe. It makes a huge difference. stateoftelaviv.com. All one word. Now, back to the podcast.
I'm not surprised, but Israel goes back into, after not having been there, finds all these terrorists, shock, horror, and the world reacts to military action to remove the terrorists as, oh my gosh, Israel is attacking a hospital again. Guys, this isn't a hospital.
It's a terror base.
Exactly. And so, you know, I don't know. To me, watching all of the sacrifice that went into the whole Shifa operation initially, it would just seem, and I'm not a great military mind, I admit it, but it would just seem to me, you know, common sense to secure such a hard fought area, both from a PR perspective and from an actual war perspective. Just keep a presence, make sure it doesn't turn into the shit show, pardon my French, that it has become again. And apropos, before you jump in,
yeah,
guy, he's about to go through the computer screen.
The screen.
Exactly. Before you do that, because you did tie it into kind of the day after. And of course, we're already reading this kind of thing of the terrorists coming back in and taking over hospitals. We're starting to hear and see and read of powerful clans and criminal gangs basically taking over the streets, taking over the aid shipments, which we're going to get to in a moment. And, you know, you've mentioned it, I think, in a previous discussion of ours that, you know, Gaza may well look a lot like Somalia. And I would suggest sort of Somalia meets Lebanon, which is really bad for us, right? But we're already seeing the early signs of this with Shifa, with northern Gaza, with the hijacking and control of aid. So give us some light, Yaakov.
I don't know if I don't know how much light I have, but I will say about Shifa. Remember Shifa before this war? Shifa was like a terror fortress. No one would ever go in there. We would never be able to attack. We would never be able to get there. And look now, the way I look at it, we've been there twice.
Right.
Two very effective operations, and they were both successful. The first was after we pretty much evacuated all of Shifa, but the second one, which is still ongoing with the IDF operating in that vicinity and going inside the hospital, and you saw pictures of the IDF chief of staff and the head of the Southern Command all inside Shifa, that's impressive. And that shows this ability to continue to operate in a place that we used to believe is completely off limits. Never, ever, ever
right.
would the IDF be able to get there. I remember hearing about Shifa since 2008-09. Since Operation Cast Lead, when Yoav Gallant was the commander of the Southern Command, and I was in a briefing with him where he was talking about Shifa because he was the commander of that operation. And Israel did not go to Shifa then because it was like this terror fortress.
Yeah.
So look where we are 15 years later. There's something to say about that. So that's like, to me, that actually shows some light at the end of this tunnel. There is a way to continue to fight and battle, right? It's not simple. And there's no quick win, but there is a strategy of how to continue to fight. That's one. Two, and this we get back to an issue that we have spoken about in the past, all these clans and you know, who's going to take over and who's going to be in charge. We're again missing the opportunity to articulate what the plan is and what we want to see happen. And instead we're talking about, like, you know, clans and different organizations and different Palestinian rulers. This isn't going to work. And I think that we owe it to ourselves to outline what it is that we want to see happen. And we're not getting that from our government.
So yeah, this was a fascinating part of the Dermer discussion that I heard last week and you heard as well, you know, on the whole day after thing. And he did an elegant job of deflecting. And he said, look, day after, where's the plan going to come from? If it comes from Israel, it's DOA, dead on arrival, right? No one's even going to pay it. And fair point. But what was he promoting? And yes, you heard it here first, State of Tel Aviv listeners. He was promoting what I've been advocating from day one, which is some form, some variation on the multilateral force that we have in the Sinai Desert, but that it needs to incorporate Saudi and UAE military capability, and under the auspices of America, someone, but it cannot be Israel as the main enforcer and peacekeeper. It has worked in other parts of the world, that approach, and I believe that's what we need. I've been saying that honestly for months, and it was great to hear Dermer come out and say we need something like that. But he said we can't even begin to talk about the day after until we're done with Rafah, Rafah, Rafah. Okay, so park all of that. Let's go back up to the north. We have this whole specter of, you know, the cover of The Economist, Israel alone. Now, I did like a meme that I saw on Twitter today where it had two, you know, covers side by side, Israel alone and from World War II, Churchill alone. I'm good with that. But Israel alone, the Canada thing, which we're not going to go down that rabbit hole in the pod today. I'm doing that in other places, but stay tuned, listeners, because I have a lot to say about Justin Trudeau and Canada, but not today. We have the Canada thing, the concern. There are two concerns with the Canada thing, as you pointed out at the outset. One is the so-called arms embargo, the prohibition on sending any military aid or weapons from Canada to Israel. But that's kind of laughable because I think that there's a lot more, you know, trade in terms of military weaponry going the other way.
Right.
More importantly, as you also pointed out, is the precedential value, the value of the precedent.
The symbolism.
Will other countries follow? And I know that that's what is preoccupying the great minds in Jerusalem at this time, much more than the trade ledger. And so we have this prospect of, you know, Israel alone, isolation diplomatically. But what is the push? Where is all the pressure coming from? It's coming from a humanitarian crisis that turns on a lack of aid getting into Gaza, right? And Guterres and his sidekick, Lazzarini, the head of UNRWA, two very much not friends of Israel, have been at it again the last day or two, just going crazy and saying, you know, you got to let aid in, you're blocking all the aid. UK Foreign Minister David Cameron, who's also the former Prime Minister, has been really, really stumping hard on this, which frankly, I'm a bit surprised about. But this is the kind of issue of the moment. Israel let the aid in, there's famine, there's a humanitarian crisis. Is Israel actually impeding the flow of aid into northern Gaza? What's going on here?
These are claims that the world has been saying now for a long time. I could tell you, Vivian, that I've heard from numerous people in government how much the Biden administration follows the trucks on a daily basis, like wants exact counts of what's going on, how Dermer's office is calling up COGAT, the coordinator of government activities in the territories, getting from them daily lists, passing that on to the Americans. Everybody's following this stuff. You have the warnings now from the WFP and the WHO, and of course, UNRWA and Guterres and all these different organizations talking about the fear of famine and starvation, et cetera. Israel is allowing in trucks. It's allowing in aid. But we also have to keep in mind is that a lot of this aid is being taken hostage to an extent, right, to use the term of what Hamas does, by Hamas. And it's not going out to the different, to the people, right? So it's also to have this expectation as if Israel is impeding the aid and it's our fault and our responsibility. I think what Israel is trying to do, and it's opened up crossings in the north and not just in the south, we can't just let any aid in. Aid does have to be inspected. It does have to be reviewed before it goes in. We want to make sure that it goes to the right people and it's going to the people of the Gaza Strip. But I also think that there's a clear way for the aid to flow in even in a freer way. Give us back our people. Stop this war. And Gaza can start to be rebuilt. I mean, there's something crazy in this expectation of Israel to do things that no other country in the world would ever do.
Yep.
Right. And that's something that I'm sorry to jump on that, but it's, come on. It's like this double standard is really just, it's crazy. It's absurd.
But the fact is, as you're saying, Israel is allowing the aid through.
Yes.
Aid is getting through. We know that it's cleared and there are dozens of trucks waiting on the Gaza side for someone to come and take it in. We know that.
Yeah.
And so clearly Biden's office knows this because Dermer's keeping them apprised. David Cameron must have the same information. So why is someone like David Cameron promoting what seems to be a fiction that Israel...
Vivian, can I ask you a question? Why is David Cameron and Joe Biden and every other world leader repeating the claims of Hamas that there are 31,000 people killed in Gaza? That is not a verified number. It's a number that is put out by the Hamas terrorist organization under the guise of the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza. That is Hamas. Why do world leaders repeat that as if it's real, as if it's true? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. Why, when Biden says we can't allow for another 30,000 people to be killed, why does it say, you know, Hamas claims 30,000 people? Why is that? Well, they would never do that with ISIS. They would never do that with Al-Qaeda. But here it's okay. Come on. We know the answer. There is a bias and a double standard against Israel that has always been there, that's latent, that's institutionalized, that's at the foundation of everything. And that's what we're up against. And we're doing stuff and we're fighting in this war of legitimacy, something that no other country has had to deal with.
And on that very powerful comment that you just made, on the heels of it, I will make a shameless plug for the essay that I have in the current issue of Sapir, which is a fabulous journal edited by New York Times columnist Brett Stevens, in which I write about exactly this, the historical, deeply entrenched institutional anti-Semitism in democracies. I focus on the US, UK, and Canada. It's all out there. It's not hidden. But you're right. Why do they just accept these things? I have to say, I'm a little more surprised that David Cameron is doing this than the Biden administration.
Yeah, but can I just say one thing about David Cameron? Because
please,
it jumped to me. David Cameron was prime minister right from back in 2014 during Protective Edge.
Right.
They suspended, the UK suspended arms deliveries to Israel after like 2 weeks into the war and didn't allow, I think, U.S. airplanes that were bringing weapons to Israel to stop and refuel in UK territory. This is what they do. I mean, you know, yeah, they could be supportive and they're friends of ours, but this is also, these are the games that everybody plays. It's okay when it's Jewish blood and it's the Jewish state that's at war. Things are a little different than, you know, someone else. That's the sad reality.
All right. Well, why don't we end up a little satire since, you know, we've now gone through the whole war and we have this incredible uncanny ability to self-impale. And we are looking this week at a discussion of the draft law. And we're going to be having our own come to Jesus moment in the cabinet in the coming days. Just sketch that one out for our listeners. What's going on with that? And, so, and Gallant's kind of putting his foot down. Minister of Defense, you have Gallant is finally, he's going to the mats on this.
I don't know how this plays out. There's another attempt, right? This goes back to what we've spoken about before, about the Haredim and the ultra-Orthodox, whether they're going to serve, they're not going to serve, and what law is going to be put forward. Netanyahu, of course, wants to pay lip service, or not only, but pay bribery, basically, political bribery to his ultra-Orthodox partners and give them what they want, which is a law that does not obligate them to serve in the IDF. But Gallant, and I have to say hats off to the guy, is standing on his heels and saying, I will not, or digging in his heels, I will not allow for a law that doesn't create equality to pass. And Netanyahu is going to try with what they call, you know, quotas, right? So basically these numbers that are going to be made up of, we'll draft this number of ultra-Orthodox every year, and then it'll go up and up and up, but it's not going to create equality. And this is one of those issues that has to be resolved in the post-October 7th reality, that we need equality and that this is not fair the way that things are being run at the moment. How this plays out, this could be the end of the government. This could be what brings down the government. And by the way, you said satire. I mean, it would be crazy to almost think about the fact that after the greatest disaster in over 50 years, October 7th, 1,200 people killed on a single day, the most Jews since the Holocaust, a complete failure, strategic blindness by this government. What will bring them down is not this, but it's this issue of religion and state that has been here for 76 years that we just have not, we've let fester and have left not resolved. And there's something, maybe poetic justice in that. I don't know.
Oh, but there's poetic justice, there's irony, there's satire, there's so much. But I do want to say this, that you kind of like, I got stuck on that standing on your heels metaphor. I was like, wait, I was trying to visualize that when you first started. How does that work? But thank you. Okay. Digging in your heels.
Digging in your heels. Yes.
So I want everybody else out there to know that I was with you on that confusion. But I think people should also be aware that there is this law, right? That at the age of 18, that's been on the books since the state was founded. At the age of 18, everybody's drafted. And what has happened in Israel over the years is every flipping year, there's a special law that's brought in to defer conscription for the draft for the ultra-Orthodox for another year, right? And we've been sputtering along like this for years. And the law has to be renewed, whatever the right term is for it in the Knesset, in the coming weeks, right? It has to be renewed for another year to give the ultra-Orthodox this exemption. And there's tremendous opposition, as you might expect, even within the Likud party, with Yoav Gallant taking this position. And I think that the people, so to speak, broadly speaking, it's about equality. And it's also about, this is a responsibility of citizenship. There are benefits and there are costs, there are responsibilities. And I always like to put it in terms of, you like roads and bridges and airports as much as I do. Well, this is another part of the roads and bridges and airports. You have to participate and you have to work. What are we going to see in the coming week, Yaakov, before I let you go?
Well, we have two important visits to Washington this week, one by Ron Dermer, who we mentioned, and Tzachi Hanegbi, the national security advisor to Netanyahu, who are going to talk about Rafah. We have Gallant, who's going to talk about weapons. We have probably a continuation to the hostage release talks. A lot of balls up in the air. And I want to hope that we'll be a little closer maybe to a deal. I want to hope.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to odds. Give me bookie odds.
Oh,
What are the
come on.
odds that we're discussing exactly the same issues next week?
Oh, 100% that we'll be discussing the same
Yeah.
issues. But the odds of a deal, I'm going to go with a safe bet 50-50.
Wow. That is so boring. So boring. But you made up for it because you were feisty all the way through. And always good to see you. Have a wonderful week. As good
You
as you
too, Vivian.
can.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Yakov.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the State of Tel Aviv and Beyond podcast. We'll keep the dispatches coming as frequently as we can. If you like what you're hearing, please take a moment, rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can check out our full library of articles and podcasts at our website, stateoftelaviv.com. State of Tel Aviv is an independent media venture, and we rely on subscribers to support our work. If you are not yet a paying subscriber, please consider taking the plunge today. Each person really does make a huge difference, especially in these very challenging times in Israel. It is important that you stay informed and current and seek out a range of perspectives. This is a pivotal moment in Israeli history. It is not a time to be passive and disengaged. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. I'm Vivian Berkovich, signing off from deep inside the state of Tel Aviv.